Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to week one of how to be an ethical customer. To be an ethical customer, we called it different things in different places. I am Mordechai Torchiner, and thank you so much for being here, because otherwise it would be lonely. I'm going to echo what Loretta had said. I'd like to echo a lot of what she said, frankly, but in particular, just the cell phones. If people could make sure their ringers are off, silent, vibrate, whatever setting will work, that would be great. Of those who signed up in advance, how many received the email from me where I sent out the source sheet in advance? Okay. Anyone who signed up in advance and didn't get the source sheet? Okay. So I think I know the story with yours. Gmail is doing very strange things. I'll ask you afterwards. I sent it, I think, on Thursday of last week, Thursday or Friday, something like that. Don't know. Well, we're going to have to see based on the list. Anybody who gives Loretta their email address, Loretta will hopefully give it to me, and then we'll see. Make sure that everybody is getting the emails that are sent to them. So our topic for the series is being an ethical customer. And there's an awful lot we could talk about. What I want to try to do is offer a little bit about various issues that come up, as opposed to taking one or two items and dealing with them in great depth. We're going to see a little bit about multiple items. One book that I'm going to quote repeatedly through the series, very worth knowing about, is a book called Moral Issues of the Marketplace in Jewish Law. And it's written by Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine. He passed away a couple of years ago. I had the privilege of getting to interact with him somewhat. Brilliant as a rabbi, as well as an economist and as an ethicist. And he wrote quite a bit. That book in particular relates to a lot of what we're going to discuss. But in general, he wrote several books on Jewish business ethics. He's a name that should be known. So we're going to look at bargaining. And bargaining comes up in various contexts, but the basic format, I think, is the same. You want to buy something, somebody else wants to sell it to you, but there's a difference in price. What you're willing to pay is here, what they're willing to accept is here, and you have to find some way to meet at a point that will be reasonable, something that will satisfy both sides. That's a basic explanation of what goes on when you bargain. But I want to look at four stages. The opening stage is flattery. When you want to butter up the person who is selling the item and get them to lower their price. That's the opening stage. The second stage is where you calculate for yourself what the item is worth. Maybe you have special knowledge, maybe you don't have special knowledge, but you calculate what it's worth. The third stage is where you make your offer. And then the fourth stage is where you negotiate. Now, a lot of this could be reversed to the position of the seller, but we're talking about being an ethical customer. What I want to establish in the course of the next hour is the line that Judaism walks between viewing the customer on the one hand as a citizen who is responsible for the welfare of other citizens, who can't just say, well, I'm looking after my own good, and on the other hand, somebody who is an opponent and who wants to make the best possible deal for herself. Right? Because we exist in both capacities. On the one hand, we're not the enemy of the seller. We want the seller to benefit too. But on the other hand, we are really doing this for ourselves. So that's what I'd like to look at in the course of our discussion of bargaining. What is my responsibility to the other person versus what am I allowed to do for my own sake? Clear? Okay. For those who haven't been to one of our sessions before, if you have a question, a comment, please, don't wait for the end. That's not a good idea. In the middle, in the beginning, whatever it is, please do ask. And also, I should have said in the beginning, but again, those who have been here before know, I'm glad also to discuss things that come up via email afterwards. If some question comes up that wasn't addressed, something you'd like to look at further, please do email me, and I'll be glad to continue the conversation. So we start with source number one. And this is one of many, many examples you could bring. It's a popular story. Somebody goes to a garage sale, pays $5 for something, and finds out that it's worth $50,000. Right? We've heard such stories before. Of course, it doesn't happen to us. But nonetheless, the stories exist. Someone out there is doing this. So in number one, you see a story out of Las Vegas, which is as good a place as any for this sort of thing to happen, I suppose. Garage sale treasure. A local bargain hunter buys Dolly Original. How's this for a return on your investment? Spend $5 at a Henderson garage sale and walk away with a piece of art worth thousands. Not last Saturday, the Saturday before, says Dave Shaw, I can't do the accent, telling News 3 about the neighborhood sale he visited late in the afternoon. Shaw is a treasure hunter, for lack of a better term. He buys and sells stuff on eBay, enlisting the help of his wife, who also helps him with research. But back to that one Saturday in Henderson. He had quite a lot of good stuff there. A lot of it was expensive, Shaw said. And then I looked to my left and saw the painting and picked it up and said, how much is this? And he said, $10. And I said, well, I have five. And he said, okay. There's your bargain. He wanted 10. I said, five. He said, fine. What he walked away with, he later found out, was an original 1977 print by Salvador Dali titled Reflection. Shaw is not an art novice. He has an eye for things like this. He suspected that this could be the real deal. So he called friends who put him in contact with friends in the art world. He called an expert in Washington State, and the rest is history. Ethical or not ethical?
Not ethical.
Not ethical. Anyone say ethical? Yeah, we have some people saying ethical. This looks like the split between the sides of the room almost. Okay, guys, wait. All right, Stephen and then Marilyn, yeah.
Lessonly cannot make an unreasonable profit out of the ignorance of someone else.
May not profit unreasonably. Question, what is unreasonably? No, but what's unreasonable? In other words, how do you define the limits of what is reasonable in terms of your profit? There is an idea, Talmudically, based on a biblical verse, that I'm not allowed to engage in what's called ona'a. If there is a going rate for an item, then as a seller, I'm not allowed to overcharge, and as a consumer, I'm not allowed to underpay, taking advantage of the other person's ignorance or taking advantage of some circumstance. However, in this case, number one, I don't know that there's a going rate for a Dali painting. I don't think that you have enough of an ongoing market necessarily to establish that. But number two, I'm not clear on what the threshold is for overcharging and undercharging in this case. Marilyn.
Well, I was going to say it's ethical if the story doesn't tell us the end, if he shared the profit with the seller.
Right, I don't believe he did. If I remember correctly from the end of the article, no, there was no discussion of sharing it. Yes, and then.
How does the actor play into this buyer beware?
Yeah.
So
is there a concept of seller beware? And just, look, you know, you sold it to me. It was your responsibility to investigate what it was worth. It's not necessarily mine. That's a way to look at it. Sandy.
I agree with that as well. But the buyer may have had some intuition, but he did not know, you know, that it really was a Dolly. He had a suspicion. The thing he may have done is to say, you know, I think this is maybe more valuable than you think it is, and maybe he could have shared that with people. But I don't think he had a responsibility. And I agree, buyer beware. If you were advertising, the owner should have done his due diligence as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you can see the different sides. I mean, you're expressing the tension both ways, but adding the point, which is clear in the article, to me at any rate, that standing at the garage sale, this buyer, Dave Shaw, suspects, but doesn't know. He has an eye for things, and he says, this doesn't look like, you know, you're amateur or whatever. And then he goes home and looks it up. He doesn't know, looking at it, hey, this is a dolly. Yes, there was a hand back here. Yeah.
I think you got out of context. I totally underappreciate the people that are saying, you know, maybe it would be ethical to share something, you know, in a certain scenario. But in a Barnes-Hill scenario, the person putting out the goods had every opportunity on his or her own to value what they're putting out. It's something they decided they didn't want. And the exact thing happened to us. We're cleaning out my late mother-in-law's home, and there was one painting that I really liked. I didn't care the value of it. I said, do not put it out. They were putting everything out there on the street for people to take, because she didn't have very good art. But there was one thing I really liked, and I said, I'm keeping it. So I hired her that year. It turned out it was worth a lot more than I ever would have suspected it be worth. Not 50, but quite a number of thousands. And the point is, the fellow could have hired a valuator for a few hundred bucks to value all his paintings, but he wanted to know the real value. Chose
to put it
up in a garage sale. It was his choice. Mm. He's the seller.
It's the same with antique furniture. People value them very much, but they put it up in a garage sale. They don't want it. Right. I don't see that as anything because when you're selling, you have every opportunity to
serve what the value gets. Right. Okay, so I'm going to take Marlene and then I'm going to go further.
Sorry. Yeah. I'll repeat it. Yes.
You know, so you never know what the buyer wants to sell today or where he got it from, and he may not have thought it was a original beginning. Or he got it.
Right, and Marlene points out that when you're dealing with valuing art, you have to take into consideration the fact that there could be, you know, items out there that have a name on them. It doesn't mean they're actually made by the famous Salvador Dali. This is actually Abraham Dali, his cousin. The, you know, it's you can come up with all sorts of possibilities, and so there is a definite element of uncertainty involved. There's much more we could say about this. I'm going to come back to this case because it's going to figure into the second of our elements, the issue of calculating something's worth and potentially concealing information. All right, one more, and then we're going to go further.
I mean, this is sort of, they play devil's advocate, but years ago there was an article in the New York Times about applying game theory to breaking up a household. It's all going over the umbrella of the money. And I'm wondering, the emotional value of that dally to the owner who's selling it, to the seller, it's worth anything to get rid of it. I'm throwing it out in a garage sale.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you can take the emotional value versus the economic values.
Right. And it's a good question. Can you factor an emotional value, or in this case, negative emotional value?
Right.
You know, he doesn't want it. Well, then the question, you could play this out in a few different ways. I'm going to go a little further with this, though, because really the fundamental question is the one that we've identified here. Am I entitled to conceal that which I know? And then let's go a little bit further. Well, you know, we'll go further in a minute. I'm not there yet. But there's a further question that you have to ask as you go along. But let's start with the opening gambit, the flattery. So Rabbi Dr. Levine, in source number 2 in his work, Moral Issues of the Marketplace in Jewish Law, offers the following scenario, which I excerpted a little bit from, but I'll give you the background here. He talks about negotiations between a union of university professors and the university. And the university, of course, wants to offer less financially, less in terms of benefits, and the professors are all negotiating for more. Right? There's no surprise, we know the way that this works. The union presents its demands, the university comes back with a very hard line, and then the negotiator for the university is a fellow by the name of Pelt. I mean, it's an imaginary situation, but it's a fellow by the name of Pelt in this story. The negotiator on behalf of the professors is a fellow named Weinman, and look at what happens in number 2. Not wanting to end his response to the union's demands on a sour note, Pelt ended his presentation with a quip. Looking at Weinman with a mischievous twinkle in his eye, Pelt said, "Professor Weinman, you're trying to extend your famous law of household consumption to new frontiers." Now, as he goes on to explain within within the piece. This Professor Weinman does indeed have something that he once formulated about household consumption, and it could sort of tangentially apply to the union negotiations, but it is by no means a famous law. It's something which even accomplished economists would not really be aware of. What is the negotiator on behalf of the university doing by invoking the law?
Flattering him.
Flattering him, right? He wants to make him feel good. He wants to make him feel positive towards him. Oh, wow. This fellow Pelz, who's negotiating on behalf of the university, who has no background in economics, he's heard of my law. Either because he knows economics and he values what I say, or because he has looked into who I am and he's read my research and he's applying what I've said. Amazing. It's going to make him feel very good. Example from regular sort of non-ivory tower bargaining and negotiations. You walk into the garage sale, you walk into the store, and you say, you know, I really love that. Hey, that's a beautiful tie. That's a great hairstyle, whatever it is. When you don't actually mean it. It's only meant to open the person up a little bit. Okay or not okay?
If you mean it, it depends.
If you mean it, it's okay. Meaning if it's not a tactic. So there's a word in Hebrew called chanufa. Chanufa. And it usually is translated as flattery. If you take a look at source number 3, this comes from Rabbi Ephraim Lunshit, as I noted there, author of the biblical commentary Kli Yakar. And he's commenting on a biblical verse, V'lo tachanifu et ha'aretz, which is generally translated as, you shall not corrupt the land. And he says on that, one who gives something to a person who doesn't deserve it, so that the recipient will then give him something, is performing an act of chanufa. When you give something to somebody only because you want him to give you something you don't deserve, and he applies it to giving an item, but also to giving a compliment. When you're just doing it for the sake of getting something from the other person in return, it would be inappropriate.
That's a bribe.
Yes, essentially it's a form of bribe. The only difference between this and bribery is that the other fellow isn't the judge. In other words, one of the elements that makes bribery so bad is that you're inducing someone to violate the public trust. Bribing an officer, bribing a judge. In this case, it's his own business. You know, if he chooses to accept the flattery and sell for a lower price, that was his decision. So I'm not sure I would quite put it on the same plane as bribery, but it's corruption. Yes.
I'm going to make a somewhat sexist statement. I think this happens to women a lot. Oh, you look so lovely. Oh, you just end up paying more somehow than you intended because it makes you, the seller makes you feel good.
I am so not going to touch this.
But it does happen a lot. It does happen a lot, yes.
So do you think all cases then of flattery, and flattery for the sake of, where you're saying it and you don't mean it and it's really just to butter the other person up, are all such cases inappropriate? Yes.
What if the interaction is intended by the seller or the provider as trying to build trust as opposed to trying to flatter you?
Well, trying to
build... The motivation matters.
Right. Trying to build trust by lying?
No, by lying.
But, right.
We're not lying,
we're not lying. So part of the question...
You really don't love the tie, but it might just have nice colors, so it attracts your attention. And you say the tie is nice, you compliment a woman's jewelry. You know, you might not be in love with it, but you just want to notice that, make the person feel that you're aware of it.
Right. I think the second half, though, is very important. The second half of the sentence is you're doing it in order to get something in return. If I see somebody and just, you know, comment to them, wow, what a lovely tie, and it's not to get something, but I want them to feel good, then I, you know, what would be wrong with that? unless it's an ugly tie, and I am now inducing them to walk around with this, you know, again and again and again, that's a different problem. Some things are. Yes. So the question was asked, what about the promises that the candidates make in order to gain the confidence of the voter, or the voter will vote on? It's a really good question. It's a really good question. We could have a class at some point on electoral ethics. After the election, yes. Yeah. Absolutely does. And maybe that feeds in a little bit to actually a caveat I wanted to note on the flattery issue. And it's something that's going to apply to a lot of our discussion about being an ethical consumer, not just today, but in general. And that is the importance of communal standards and what the understanding is that everybody brings to the table. It's not really legitimate to say that ethics prohibit all forms of irrelevant compliments and all forms of buttering the person up and so on. One of the points that Rabbi Dr. Levine makes in the course of presenting this story, this fake story about the university negotiations, is that in the beginning, when Pelt and Weinman sit down together and they have a history of negotiating and neither one likes the other, nonetheless, Pelt opens by asking Weinman, how is his family doing, and so forth. It's not that that's deceiving Weinman into thinking that they're friends. It's broadcasting a message of, hi, I'd like to talk to you. It's a normal way to begin a conversation. Take a look at source number 4. Rabbi Dr. Levine says, speaking one way while thinking another is prohibited because such conduct sends out a false signal. In the case at hand, no false signal is sent out by the pleasantries Pelt and Weinman exchange before the bargaining session begins. This is so because each party does not mistakenly take his opposite number's inquiries about family as a gesture of friendship. Instead, these inquiries are taken as conversation for the sake of signaling to each other that they desire to be on speaking terms. So there's a difference between flattery and normal social conversation, something that simply establishes that we're supposed to be having a friendly dialogue. It's the difference between the two is the social norm. What do people assume about what the other person is doing? And much of what will define behavior as ethical or not depends on what the other person's expectations are. It's flattery if they think I'm serious, and it's inappropriate then. But if they know that this is just the way people talk, you know, I haven't seen you forever, oh, it's so great to see you, whatever it is, if that's the way people normally speak, then even if he's not sincere, nonetheless, we're going to be better with that than if it's really something that people should, that people take seriously, and where people assume, no, what that person is telling me is what's really in their mind, what's really in their heart. Yes?
But in this case,
yeah.
The two know each other.
Yep.
And they have already preset this pattern.
Yeah.
But if they've never met before, don't know each other, they may listen through what he just said.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. It depends a lot on what the existing relationship is between them. Do they know each other? Have they been doing this for years? Have they never met? What society are they coming from? What has their prior experience been elsewhere? We have to ask ourselves the question of what baggage these parties bring to the table, and what is it fair for one to assume about the other? So that's the opening issue. That's the flattery issue. But let's move now into a meaty topic, and it's the one that brings us back to the garage sale, concealing information. And what I want to talk about is, in particular, the Rothschild myth. This is an unbelievably pernicious story, which has somehow survived for almost two centuries, I believe. And it's really, I got fooled by it. I actually used to use it when teaching business ethics classes, not knowing that it was fake, not knowing that the story actually didn't happen. But as you see in the article in source number 5, the story's been debunked. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to read part of the article, and then I'll tell you the version of the story that I had heard. In the summer of 1846, a political pamphlet bearing the ominous signature Satan swept across Europe, telling a story which, though lurid and improbable, left a mark that can be seen to this day. The pamphlet claims to recount the history of the richest and most famous banking family of the time, the Rothschilds. And its most enduring passage told how their vast fortune was built upon the bloodshed of the Battle of Waterloo, whose bicentennial falls this year. I don't know why I'm having trouble with the word. Here is the story that Satan told. Nathan Rothschild, the founder of the London branch of the bank, was a spectator on the battlefield that day in June 1815, and as night fell, he observed the total defeat of the French army. This was what he was waiting for. A relay of fast horses rushed him to the Belgian coast, but there he found to his fury that a storm had confined all ships to port. Undaunted, "Does greed admit anything is impossible?" asked Satan. He paid a king's ransom to a fisherman to ferry him through wind and waves to England. Reaching London 24 hours before official word of Wellington's victory, Rothschild exploited his knowledge to make a killing on the stock exchange. In a single coup, announced the pamphlet, he gained 20 million francs. Trading on information that nobody else yet had. Now, the version of the story that I heard was even better. The version of the story that I initially read went this way. Rothschild had scouts out there at the Battle of Waterloo. The scouts came back ahead of everybody else with word that the British had won, and that Rothschild did what? Can you guess? This is what differentiates between a Rothschild and us, maybe. What did he do? He sold. He sold his British assets. He sold his British assets, and everybody's watching. What is Rothschild going to do? And when he sells, they all sell. Everything tanks, and he buys at the bottom. And then makes his killing. It's a great story. Yes?
Did you hear ever of the homing pigeons being involved in this story? That there were homing pigeons on the field, and they came back to England, of course, ahead of the word.
Okay, so even better. Even better. Now we have birds involved. So that's the story that I had heard. And the question is that ethical to do? And it's a great question. The problem is the story never happened. If you flip the page to the continued part of the article, this fellow, Darren Vale, is the author of the pamphlet. Every aspect of Darren Vale's tale, the ruthlessness, the guile, the greed, represents a derogatory racial stereotype, and he was writing at a moment when such attitudes were having one of their periodic surges of popularity in Europe. I wasn't aware there was a time when they weren't. But, okay? The story was also false. Nathan Rothschild was not at Waterloo or even in Belgium at the time. There was no channel storm and he made no great killing on the stock market. Yet the Satan pamphlet, translated into many languages and reprinted many times, gave this legend such a grip on history that, albeit often in modified or diluted forms, references to it can still be found today, both in popular culture and in scholarly works. Versions appear in a Hollywood film of 1934, the 2009 Sebastian Fox novel A Week in December, past editions of the Dictionary of National Biography and Encyclopedia Britannica, in Elizabeth Longford's acclaimed 1970s biography of the Duke of Wellington, and with a very different analysis in Neil Ferguson's authorized history of the Rothschilds. Perhaps more predictably, the story provided the plot for a Nazi film of 1940 entitled The Rothschild Shares in Waterloo, and the tale can be read on many anti-Semitic websites. And even in economics textbooks. Yes.
Did he not fund Napoleon in this war? Is that where it started?
I don't know.
But history, there are historical notes that he actually funded that war.
That's entirely possible. I don't know. My point that I'm making in bringing this is not so much to discuss is it a true story or not, although I think that the historical elements of it are interesting. But the question fundamentally is, would this, had he done it, in either version, buying based on information that he has that no one else has, or it's not insider trading. That's a very important distinction. What insider trading is where you are an insider, or you have someone who is an insider who has access to information that he's giving you that you don't have a right to. He has every right to this information. He's not an insider. But the question of trading on information that others don't have, or the version that I told you, actively fooling others so that they do something which then gives you an opportunity. Ian, you were going to say, or we're past the point, right?
Major bank institutions in Europe, in the chosen persuasion, financed both sides of the war. Even after the First World War, financed
yeah.
both.
Don't know. Don't know.
All of this is according to journalist groups.
Meaning?
They're always trying to be ahead of the first one to have a secret and publish
something.
So, and that way they gain reputation.
Well, what's the difference between taking advantage of taking advantage of information that others don't have and being a journalist getting a scoop? Is it? I'm not sure.
Well, you're not making as much money.
Yes, Elaine, and then Stephen.
Isn't that how the commercial world works? We may not like it when we observe those things, but truthfully, if you look at the history of probably any family or any corporation,
right. So that's the big question.
Not illegal things, like insider trading, that's different. Mm-hmm. Just being able to read the signals and pick up what's going on today and using it.
Right. If we don't like somebody taking advantage of information that he has that's not obtained illegally, then are we now to say that businesses aren't entitled to come up with a better way to do something and then make a profit on it, right? Are we now going to say that you can't invent a new technology, that a drug maker is not allowed to invent a new medicine without promptly open sourcing everything, making it all accessible to the world in order that everybody should have an equal playing field when they're the ones, not only are they the ones who had the information, but they may have invested in the information, right? Not necessarily with Rothschild standing there at the battlefield, but if he hired homing pigeons or scouts or whoever it is, he invested in it. Does everybody else have a right to his hard work? Stephen.
Your instance is completely unethical, creating information in a situation falsely. That is absolutely unethical. But the second situation here is something that I'm trying to deal with. I'm not certain about it. He was in a position to do so, and he took advantage of it. And that's what was said. Are we to be condemned for doing that? Was anyone else denied that opportunity to as well?
Right. So I want to look at this in a couple of different ways. Right? We do see a difference between, as Stephen said, spreading false information, right, in the scenario that I gave where he sells, and simply taking advantage of the information that we have, right? The difference would be between, at the garage sale, to go back to our opening case, if this buyer, Dave Shaw, is standing there and he says, that's a really interesting painting, I'd like to buy it. And the fellow says to him, okay, that's $10. He says, $10? $5. And he says, okay, fine, you can have it, versus where he asks for the painting, and the guy says to him, $10, he says, $10? Are you kidding? I know who made that, and it's worthless. In which case he has now actively provided misinformation. Right? I mean, clearly we're more offended by that version of the story. Can we draw a line between ethical and unethical here? So there are two issues involved. Issue number one, from a Jewish ethics perspective, is the issue of dishonesty. If you take a look at source number six, a passage out of the Talmud, says that there are three types of people, or three types of behavior, really, that God despises. And the first one is the one that's relevant for us, but I brought the whole line in the interests of completeness. A person who speaks one way with his mouth and another with his heart. In Hebrew, echad bepeh ve'echad balev. If a person says one thing and means something else. Deception, in other words. We have numerous biblical prohibitions against lying to others, and about we have laws talking about how we have to distance ourselves from falsehood. And that's the first point. The second one is if you know testimony on behalf of somebody in a case and you choose not to testify. And the third is if you witness impropriety by somebody else and testify alone. And the point that's being made there is because under biblical law, one witness is not able to actually indict somebody. You need two witnesses. So if you testify alone, then all you're doing is giving this person a bad reputation. You're just saying negative things about them without any practical application. That's its own case to be discussed at another time because there's more to talk about. But the first point here of the three is the one that's directly relevant. Dishonesty is something that we can't accept. That's number one. Number two, though, let's play the case out. Let's say, going back to the garage sale, he buys it for $5. He finds out it's a dollar. News report says, fellow buys the painting for $5 and it turns out to be a Salvador Dali worth thousands. The owner of the painting in Henderson, Nevada, sees the news report. Does he have the ability to say, this is what we call, in Talmudic terminology, mekach ta'ut, an errant or an erroneous transaction? I didn't know, I would never have sold it had I known what this was worth. Does he have the ability to say that I want to back out of the sale?
He can try.
General sense I'm getting, general vibe I'm getting is no, you can't. Take a look, please, at source number 7. Also a Talmudic passage. There was a famine in a city called Neher Da'at in Babylon. The population sold its great houses in order to buy food, meaning there were people there who had large homes and they were starving. So they said, I'll sell the house in order to be able to get food. But before they could actually buy food with the money, grain showed up. Boat comes down the river, and now suddenly there is a supply of grain. Grain is a lot cheaper. Rav Nachman, sage on the spot, ruled that the purchasers had to return the grain houses to their owners. They had to refund the sale. Why is that?
They were buying it.
Well, it's not false pretenses. It was duress. Meaning they thought that they were dealing with a certain circumstance, which no one had deceived them about. We're not saying that the sellers knew, that the buyers of the houses knew that grain was coming down the river. No one did anything inappropriate. However, they wouldn't have sold had they known that grain was coming. That's the argument. There's a similar case that's brought, not in a case of sale, but in a case of inheritance. The following scenario is brought Talmudically. You have somebody who goes to the doctor and gets a terrible report. The doctor says he's not going to live out the week. And so he says, he's beside himself, and decides he wants to give away all of his assets. And he writes away all his assets to whoever it is. Then he survives. Says the Talmud, if he saved any of his assets for himself, then he can't reverse what he has done. Because that showed that he was thinking, I might survive. However, if he gave everything away, then he demonstrated that he clearly believed he wasn't going to survive the week, and therefore this was made on the basis of a false assumption, and and it is reversed. He hired a second-rate scribe. What's the problem? Yeah, Stephen and then Ian.
The auto manufacturer makes the vehicles, and then they discover at some time later, unaware to them, when they manufacture the vehicles, that there's a defect. They advise the public that you must return the vehicles for repair. If you don't, should they be legally responsible if an injury occurs because you did not take up their request to return the vehicle for repair?
No. How would that connect, though, to this? Where's the link? It's a good question in its own right, and frankly, I thought about introducing a class on the whole Volkswagen thing. But that's, I'm not sure it ties into this one. Ian, and then.
With the intricacies of the marketplace.
Yeah.
The money market.
Yeah.
Fluctuations of the Canadian dollar versus the US dollar. Fluctuates on a daily basis.
Right.
Let's say Canadian trades at $1.30.
Okay.
Ours is $1.29.
Yeah.
Do you have a right to go back to
good. Now, Ian is asking a very important question. Hold the question for a minute. Hold the question for a minute, but it's a very important question. Marilee, and then we'll come back to Ian.
There's a show called Fake a Fortune About Art, and they had one case where a family threw out a painting by mistake, and someone found it on the rubbish tip. And they, the one who took it to the show, the way of the Fake a Fortune, but they actually traced it back to the house, the original mistake of throwing it out. And the law, the court, viewed in favor of the family. They said, had we known what this was when we were throwing it out, we wouldn't have thrown it out, and they got it back. So, despite the fact that it was saved from the garbage dump by the neighbor.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So the I'm not sure. I didn't look into what the law, you know, governing this would be locally. But going back to Ian's point, could you legitimately say, when the price changes, well, wait a minute, I wouldn't have sold at the previous price? There are stores and, you know, companies that will market this, but that's a bonus that they provide. That's not considered normal. When an airline says, if the price goes down, whatever, we're going to give you the lower price, that's not the norm. That's considered usually an incentive to get you to spend more money. So if you take a look at source number 9, I'm going to come back to number 8, but if you take a look at source number 9, this is from an anthology commentary that we titled Tosafot. If you're familiar with Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, classic commentator on both biblical texts, as well as the Talmud, as well as Jewish law. So he had several grandsons-in-law who were heads of yeshivot, academies of study in Western Europe, and they authored commentaries of their own in their own style to the Talmud, which are anthologized as Tosafot, which literally means additions, A-D-D-I-T-I-O-N-S. So that's these additions on the Talmud. And Tosafot here in source number 9 is dealing with an interesting case. The case of the sale of an animal, the cow, a bull, in which a farmer buys an animal, buys a bull, and the bull turns out to be violent. The bull gores. And he says, well, I didn't want a goring bull. I wanted a bull that I could use for plowing. And it's considered like a different creature. I thought I was getting a farm animal. I didn't think I was getting a violent bull. To which the person who sold it to him said, I didn't know any different. I thought you wanted to slaughter it. I thought you wanted to have burgers. I didn't know that you were planning on keeping the animal around. So the question then is it legitimate for you to say, I didn't want this kind, I wanted that kind? And the case they give is the case in which the animal actually goes out and gores someone and the animal is put down. Can he come back and say, that's not the kind of bull I wanted? So Tosafot, well, take a look at what happens in source number 9. If you will ask, he says, we could testify regarding anyone who buys a cow that he didn't intend for it to die or be killed right away. I don't care whether you thought he wanted a plow animal or whether you thought he wanted an animal that he would be able to slaughter. Either way, he didn't want to lose it the next day. So why can't that be his statement that earns him the refund? Tellus Vogt says, we could answer that the purchaser is willing to accept that risk and enter the transaction. In other words, as other commentators go on to amplify, everybody knows when they get into a transaction that they're not getting the best deal possible. There is no such thing as selling at the maximum possible price, and there is no such thing as buying at the absolute minimum price. It doesn't exist. You know when you buy something that it is entirely possible that it's cheaper somewhere else. You know when you sell something that it is entirely possible that you, somewhere else they're getting a better price for it. You know when you engage in a transaction on foreign exchange, you know that it could be there's going to be a better deal tomorrow, and you know when you sell something at a garage sale that you may not have all the information. There is a certain norm to the way business works, and it's accepted. Yes?
How about responsibility? Shouldn't someone take responsibility, such as the person who's selling items at a garage sale? You know that you hear stories about things being worth a lot and not just junk. So why would they look into it before they put it out at the garage sale?
Precisely.
If you're there to purchase it, it's your good fortune.
Right, precisely. Or to go back to the phrase that was used before, caveat emptor, just applying it to the seller. Absolutely, that's what we're saying. There is a norm, and you understand that you're not necessarily going to get the best possible deal, and yes, that if there's research to be done, that's your responsibility to do it. And that takes me to the other point. That's in terms of whether he can claim mekach ta'ut to say the sale should be reversed. But the other point that goes along with it is that as long as I don't engage in misleading behavior, like the Rothschild version that I presented, in which he sells all of his British assets, as long as you don't engage in actively misleading information, it's not considered dishonest, because once again, it's normal for the buyer and the seller to be viewed as rivals. Going back to the question that I asked in the beginning, what is my responsibility as a citizen of the community to the person on the other side of the table, versus what is my responsibility to myself? Everybody knows that I am entitled to put my interests before the interests of the person on the other side of the table. If you take a look at source number 8, you get a responsum on this, Rabbi Shmuel de Medina, also known as Marash Dam, dealing also with a case of commerce in which somebody had information the other one didn't have. He says, the law has spread that all who engage in commerce rely on local practice unless they specify otherwise. That's the way it works, whatever the local norm is. If so, then it is clear that the practice of merchants is that whether they spend much more than 1/6 beyond the value or far less than 1/6 below the value, they still don't take the onah from each other. He's talking about the law of onah, which I mentioned earlier, as the law of not overcharging and the law of not underpaying. So he says, even if merchants end up needing to take a hit, they still, this is the norm, they don't, let me take a step back to explain. The law of onah is the law that one is not supposed to overcharge somebody else more than 16% above the going rate, whatever the going norm is. It's hard to calculate a going rate these days for most things. The one case I can think of locally where there is a going rate is gasoline. Where there is this bizarre collusion thing, which as an American I have never understood and will never understand. But in terms of the rule, going back to Talmudic times, remember that in Talmudic times, the Jews lived under the Romans, and the Romans had set prices for all sorts of products. And there were severe penalties if you charged somebody more than the going rate. So that worked very well with this biblical rule that you're not allowed to overcharge. So that's the rule of onah. But what Rabbi Shmuel de Medina says in source number 8 is local practice for us is that merchants will indeed spend on something more than 1/6 above its value, or they'll pay below whatever the market rate is by a differential of 1/6 of 16%, and they don't claim, this is onah. They don't claim their rights under biblical law. That's the norm. So he says, in the case that he's dealing with, in which someone wants to claim onah, he says, you can't. Because the norm here is to forgive it to each other, and therefore you don't have a claim. So what I'm suggesting is, and what I'm trying to apply here is, that when you go to the garage sale, the person who is having the sale, whether they chose to evaluate it or not, whether they paid for an appraisal or not, the person who is having the sale is not entitled to expect that the buyer is going to give him all his information about the item. It's not fair. It's not legitimate. And the buyer, on the other hand, can't expect that the seller is going to tell him everything he knows about it. There may be certain things which the law will require you disclose, right? Like there are laws about certain things that you must inform another person of. But generally speaking, the practical norm is you can't expect that I'm going to share my information with you if we are opponents in a transaction. And so that's what I would say in terms of the Las Vegas case. He's done nothing wrong. He has, as long as he doesn't actively mislead the other person, as long as he doesn't do something to conceal the idea that this may be worth more, he seems to be in the right. Flattery would be a problem. If he flatters him in an attempt to get an advantage in the negotiation, if he does something that's more than just normal pleasantries. But in terms of buying it from him and not telling him it may be a Salvador Dali, he's completely within his rights. So it appears, because it's understood. You're not a friend of the other person. As I once explained to somebody regarding labor negotiations, that's a little too fine a term for it. What we're talking about is an employment interview. A woman goes for a job. As I understand it here, I do know it from the States, but as I understand it here as well, the employer is not allowed to ask her if she is pregnant. Right? That's correct. What if she knows she's pregnant? Does she have any obligation to say anything? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Now, she knows full well she's going to get hired for this job, she's going to work for 2 months, they're going to train her, and then she's going to be out, for months and months and months. She has no obligation whatsoever to tell him. Why? Because that's the norm. That's the way this works within society. You don't have an obligation to tell him. Yes?
And if the employer says, we're hiring you for this project, it's a 6-month project, and it must be complete within that time, can you do it?
So, I don't know what the law would say. No, I'm asking, I don't know what Ontario would say. But whatever Ontario would say is what we will accept, because that's the norm. But our viewpoint is that it depends on what the norm is. Our viewpoint is that it's not a deception if this is the understanding that everybody has going into the transaction. That's what I'm saying. So whatever the norm is legally is what we're going to apply. You got to end up, yeah.
I'm going back to the number 9.
Yeah. So the question was, who is responsible in the event that you have this animal? So that's actually a really good question. If you look in the Torah in Exodus chapter 21, there's a whole set of laws that govern this, 21-22, in which we draw a very interesting distinction. They talk about animals that are either a tam or a mu'ad. Tam means simple. Can mean perfect also, but in this case it means simple. Mu'ad means that there's been a warning. Like the word aid as a witness, it means that there's been a warning. In the event that someone has an animal that is not known to be dangerous at all, it's a tam, it has no track record, and that animal then does something violent, not necessarily killing someone, because that may be a separate issue of public safety. That's its own category. But in general, it did something, it attacked somebody, it hurt somebody. Then the owner is supposed to pay, under biblical law, half damages. Whereas, if the animal is known to be dangerous and was inadequately chained up or whatever you had to do, then he has to pay full damages. And there's a lot of debate about this half damages requirement. One way you can look at the half damages is to say, really, you should have to pay for everything. But since you didn't know that it was dangerous, we'll cut you some slack, and you only have to pay half. The other way to look at it is to say, you should not have to pay anything, because you didn't know this was a dangerous animal. It had no track record. However, we're going to make people pay half damages even in a case like that, where they didn't know, because we want to ensure that people are going to be careful with their property, that they don't let their animals run around, and so on, even where they don't know of any record, because there's always a first time when this is going to happen. So there are different ways that we look at it, but the answer to your question is, if you don't know there's a danger, aside from the case where it kills somebody, which is unique, but in general, if you don't know it to be dangerous, there is some liability, but it is limited. Clear? For not having any. Right. So the answer in short is, I believe not. The answer in short is, I believe not. There is an issue of why you didn't disclose it, but in general, there is a rule in the biblical laws of damages, and as explained Talmudically, called grumma, which is indirect causation. I am not a grumma. It's an Aramaic term. I am not allowed to cause harm, directly or indirectly, but I am not financially liable for harm that I cause indirectly. If what I do is indirect, and in this case it is indirect, he sold someone else an animal, but he didn't goad the animal to cause harm, he didn't actively do anything, it's indirect. He's not allowed to do that. And he's going to have to deal with it between himself and God. And it is prescribed that he pay for the damages as a, you know, as something he should do, but a court could not hold him responsible because fundamentally he's too distant from the actual event. That's it in a nutshell. There's more to be said about it. I want to make sure to summarize what we've said, because we didn't finish the topic, which is fine, because we have week two. But I want to make sure just to summarize what we have said, and as I said in the beginning, I'm always glad to continue the conversation by email, and you will all have my emails, they're on the sheet, and also I'm going to email out afterwards to let everybody know where they can download the audio from the class. In the event that you miss a class, there is a chance to download it, but just to summarize what we said, number one is that we have this issue within business ethics of my responsibility to the rest of society, including the person on the other side of the table, and my responsibility that I have to myself and my ability to say, this is for me. In terms of flattering somebody, as in the case of the university negotiator who quotes this esoteric law of economics, the flattery is inappropriate. However, if that's the convention, this is the way people talk, and everybody knows it's just a way to signal that you want to have a pleasant conversation, then Jewish ethics will not have a problem with it. In terms of the issue of calculating the worth of the item in the case of Rothschild at Waterloo, which never happened, there are two potential problems. One is dishonesty, and the other is whether you could argue that the sale should be reversed because information was concealed. In terms of dishonesty, we say it's not dishonest if everybody understands that they are opponents and they don't expect to have the other person's information, so long as they don't do something to actively mislead. I'm not allowed to walk into the store and say, are you kidding? That's not worth more than whatever. I am an expert and I know it's not worth it. I'm not entitled to make such a statement. And in terms of the reversibility of the sale, sales are not made on the assumption that you have all of the information and you know everything about what's going to happen and you're getting the best possible price. And therefore, it's understood that that even without the information, the sale is still going to be valid. Now, I just gave a case in which you walk into the store and you actually make the assertion that this item is not worth whatever. And that's going to lead to our opening case that I hope to deal with next week in continuing the discussion about bargaining, and then we're going to go into the question of window shopping. That's our next topic. And that has a whole other element to it in the age of internet browsing and the question of, am I allowed to walk into a store, look at items, try them on, and then order them online? So we have to talk about that as well. If you do this, don't tell me. But the case is, what if I go into the store and I insist it's really not worth it, but I am fully prepared, without saying it, I'm fully prepared to pay more, and I don't divulge that. In other words, I insist it's only worth X, the bluffing question. Am I entitled to bluff? More next week, God willing. Look for my email as soon as Loretta sends me the list. Look for my email in which I will give you the link for download, and please do continue the conversation by email. Thank you very much.